There's a strong narrative about the West, that China is this scary, ominous power, and there's a bit of a disconnect, I think, because I've never been to China, didn't understand it. So we sort of went that direction with Tony. He's an IT specialist, but he came from China here in 1996, and he's still got family back in China, and he came from a farm, and we talked about the difference in class, talked about what led to Taiwan having this feeling of uprising or wanting a sense of identity, and then also as well how to optimize your business and how to do things more efficiently and effectively, because things don't have to be complicated in business. Things don't have to be, you know, people like to think they understand technology, that they've got it all worked out, but you don't know what you don't know. And the people that become successful in life, I find, are the ones that are willing to delegate away power and allowing those people to make those choices for you instead of you having to learn it, try and do everything yourself, because then you bottleneck. You can't. There's a limit to how good you can be at something. So we talked to Tony, a lovely man. We'll kick into it.
I'll be curious, like, actually what it's like to live in China. It's one of the, I've been to a few countries, but I haven't been to China. And, you know, I feel like the Western society likes to paint them as, you know, this evil power that's taking over the world. But I don't, I find that's a narrative as opposed to the reality. What's it like in China to live there?
I probably want to put it into a different lifestyle. Yeah. In there, the people can live peacefully and happily. Uh-huh. Depends on what you're looking for. After a few years, like 20 odd years, I live in New Zealand. Of course, I feel like, oh, I probably won't be able to live back in China. But when I was living in China, like even with my parents now in China, right? We look at COVID lockdowns and all those strict regulations in China, and people's life must be tough. I talk to my parents; they don't feel that. They feel safe.
Mm.
So I think that is one of the things that we look at it different, because lots of things are in control over there. Yeah. But in here, we say when you lose freedom, you lose everything. That's kind of like how we think. But over there, they probably say, oh, you need to have somewhere to live. You need to have food on your table, you know. And once you have that kind of security for the people's life in China, and people don't want to change, because they say, oh, at least I have a place to live. I can feed my family. You know, my children still getting educations, even though sometimes struggle with medicals and things like that. We struggle here too, you know, sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different way of struggle.
Do you think, what do you think sort of influences their viewpoint, you know? Like the say, because I don't know, it probably shouldn't stereotype people, but it seems like there's a lot more focus around supporting and respecting your elders.
Yep.
And education.
Yeah.
And work ethic.
Yeah.
And then even their TikTok over there, they show children engineering and arts and restrict in terms of what they see. There's a completely different, I think, approach to life.
Yep. That's what I put it down as lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like in New Zealand, right? I have a friend, he lives in a farm. He really enjoying it. And I kind of enjoy it, but when I talk to my wife, and my wife say, no, I don't think you can survive in the farming area.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay to visit, but when you live there, you have to do all those hard work. You have to mow the lawns, and you have to do all those, you know, menial jobs. And it's like, you won't be able to survive, because I'm not a person that is really with that kind of hand-on. Like, I don't even touch my garden at home. So, yeah. So.
Yeah, that would be hard. No, just more like, is there like a religion that influences that culture? Is it the fact that, you know, I feel like every country has propaganda, us as well, like that influences that sense of security and scarcity, like, hey, like, there's dangerous things out there, I feel comfortable to have my home, to have my education, to have my family. What do you think sort of leads to that viewpoint? Not that you haven't analyzed that ever. I don't know. But
I actually have lots of thoughts about that too.
Oh, yeah?
I'm really into histories and things like that.
Okay.
In China, because of, like in New Zealand, we have a very peaceful life and everybody kind of have at least have something to eat. you know, children have educations and you have a house and government is looking after you and that kind of things. Mm-hmm. But in China, it's not like that. Even before, like after I was born, they still have famines and things are not abundant. I remember when I were, I grew up in a country, a village.
Mm.
So, my parents at the time is still like farmers. We live on the whatever produced from the farm. And you don't have social welfare. So if you really don't have enough, you don't have enough.
Mm.
So materials are very scary. Not like in here. Well, you have abundance of everything. If you really don't have something to eat, you can go out and probably ask the government to support you or the food banks. Or, you know, you have a source of getting means to go by. But over there, probably the last 20 years is a lot better. But definitely when I was growing up, things are not abundant. So you lack of that kind of security. So whoever can provide that kind of a security or material for life to sustain, and that is something that we want to hold on to it. And over the histories in China, things happen just like that, up and down, up and down. And the bottom line, there's no bottom line. When you have no food, you starve to death.
Mm.
That's it. So not like in here, you do have a bottom line.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You can eat out of the bins. There's heaps of food.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But over there, it's not.
Mm.
Yeah, so there's no bottom line. So I think that is what most of the Chinese people, they find it, they need securities. Like even in the society in China now, you don't have, like in here, you have pensions, right? So in China, they do have a level of pensions, but not is universally applied. If you are a farmer, that means like you really don't have much securities.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's strange, eh? You would think that they would be more incentivized to help a farmer because of how important and limited the resources are, but...
It's probably different because the farmer group in China is kind of... they have been treated...
Lower class?
Not lower class because the incomes is low.
Yeah.
It's the whole society structure is different. Like in here, the farmers are quite wealthy.
You maybe don't say that to them, but comparatively. Comparatively. Yeah.
Right. It's interesting. This is how I look at it. Like in China, all those labor jobs are classified as lower class.
Mm.
But in New Zealand, it's not. If you can become a cleaner in here, even, you know, the government one that you clean the road, they make good monies.
Mm.
But in China, we call it 少大姐. It means the lowest.
少大姐.
Yeah. 少大姐. It means like they clean the row. Those people clean the row. They are the lowest class in the society. So in here, people in the office probably doesn't make as much as, you know, the tradies, the people that labors have skills.
Mm.
But in China, it's different. The people that is in the office, they might not make like in wages, it's not, but the subsidies and all the other monies add up, it's very big.
Hmm.
So they can be, the income gap is really high over there.
Does that lead to, you know, civil unrest? You know, I find with any empire you have for a period of time, wealth... And yep. Then they you know, they invest in education, resources, they start doing well. But then people that the haves and the have-nots, some people will borrow money to leverage even more to get further and further ahead. Yep. And then that gap gets bigger and bigger until there's an uprising, either violent or non-violent. Is there an unrest, do you think? Because you came from you came from lower class. I forgot the word already.
Yeah, from villages, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There is, but... In China, they do offer the opportunity for you to arise from low, even though that opportunity may not be a lot.
Mm.
Okay? So, of course, if you have a wealthy family, you always have a head start. But even if you are really low class and things like that, the society still have a door that opens. So people trying to get through the door and go higher and getting to a higher class, even though most of them, they might not success, but there's still hope in there.
Mm.
So when you're talking about that uprise, I think it won't happen unless like people see no hope.
Interesting. Do you think they sell hope?
Yeah.
Yeah, how do they? I'm sorry. I didn't expect to just talk about China, but I'm fascinated.
I love to. I actually, like, even though I have been in New Zealand for 20-something years,
yeah,
I still have a passion. I have a feeling for the country.
Mm.
Yeah. I still think I'm a Chinese.
Mm.
Yeah. Even though all my kids say, no, I'm Kiwi. I ask them to learn Chinese. They hate it. They say, I am in New Zealand. Why should I learn Chinese?
Mm.
But that recognition for me is still part in me. I still classify, I'm a Chinese or half a Kiwi.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, this is, you can choose to answer this one or not.
Okay, yeah.
Because you're knowledgeable in history. What's the whole Taiwan China thing? What's that about? Like, why is that such, as I say, that's a heavy topic. But what led to that sort of, you know, divide, and why is the West so involved in it, and why is it we're worried about World War III, if that's even a real thing, because it's just to sell weapons? What are your thoughts?
Okay, I don't want to say it from the political feeling. I say it about people, because I have lots of friends from Taiwan too.
Okay.
It's about recognition. Okay. Language-wise and everything-wise, like Taiwan and China is very close. Values and things like that, you know. Like even in Taiwan, when the communists take over, established the Chinese government in 1949, there's a group of the National Party, they moved to Taiwan. So not only the, we call it aboriginals in Taiwan, they are in that place, but there's a whole group of people that is moved from mainland into Taiwan. So this Taiwan is actually have that part of history. But even before that, there's a long relationships between like the mainland and Taiwan. It's kind of it's mingled together.
Mm.
Uh-huh. So that is the long history. So what I can see is that I have those people, Taiwan people that have connection with China, they have more of a recognition that is part of China. But for those people that grow up, they have nothing to do with China and the educations and everything, and they probably have less recognitions. Just like my children in New Zealand, they grew up in New Zealand. They have a very attached to the New Zealand culture, the New Zealand values, you know. They sang the national anthems when they're in school.
Mm.
You know, they have that association of feelings. So when I try to get them to feel like, hey, China is actually your root, they don't quite feel the same thing. So that's why I'm planning to take them back to China so they can experience it. They know, yep, this is where they come from.
Mm.
So I can't argue with my kids, because this is the recognition. They say, I am a Kiwi. So it's the same thing. I think in Taiwan, it's the same thing. If the people doesn't have that recognition, is that I belong to this group, what can you do?
Yeah.
So even historically, right, like my children, they're from China. Both their parents are from China. We speak Mandarin at home. We eat Chinese food.
Hmm.
But when you ask the kids, they say, hey, where should we go out for dinner? I say, McDonald's.
Yeah, wow. Okay. On the history, you said you find history quite fascinating. Is there a genre of history that you're really interested in? Because I like learning about history from other people. I don't like reading it. I just like asking.
It's difficult to say like which part. It's normally when I come across a topic and then I will go into do some research and see what both sides is. Because like, for example, again, in the Chinese history, right? What the Communist Party said, and what the National Party said is total two opposite things, right? And then you want to find the balance. Like, for example, when Japan invade China, the Communist Party said, we play the biggest role. We defeated Japan, right? Of course, they have lots of efforts and lots of people die because of their fighting there. But the National Party also do the same thing, because they are in the front. They confront the Japanese army. So they have done lots of job too, but because when China is controlled by Communist Party, they're trying to brush away all the things that the national have done.
Hmm.
So just like we always say, history is what the winners say.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So if you really want to understand the real history, you can't just listen to what the winners say. I think it's something, well, it's a sensitive topic in New Zealand too, you know, like in New Zealand history, we also have two parties, two sides of the picture. So you really need to go into, to listen to both sides to see what they say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not an easy thing. I find a lot of people, well, humans, I think it's probably a human thing where they don't seek the truth. They try to confirm what they already know.
Exactly. Even if you look at the news nowadays, right, you're talking about like what Americans say about China say about America. There's no balance.
Hmm.
There's no balance at all. That's why I find it's very difficult to find a new source that I can really understand what is going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have to go deep and talk to the people and how they feel, just like the COVID lockdown, right? If I don't talk to my parents and I just look at what the media say about 3 years of lockdown in China, you will say, oh, she is such a, you know, make such a bad decision. But it's difficult, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So Wuhan, no, just kidding.
Yes, I know what you want to say.
You got any insight? Nah, this is a dangerous topic.
I don't
have
insight on that, but anything can be possible, put it this way.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, it can be just conspiracy theory.
Yeah, no idea. That's the thing, is what is the truth and how do you find it?
You don't. I don't think you can find 100% truth because you don't have the fact in front of you. You don't have the information in front of you.
Mm.
Even in our computer business, it's the same thing. Right? If you don't have the information, how can you troubleshoot?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the same thing. So often, like my clients tell me, oh, the mouse is not moving. How can you identify what is the real cause of it? Right? Last week, a customer called me. So we have no network, no internet. Right? I thought, oh, it may be the router, maybe the broadband is not working and everything we try. No, at the end, it's somebody kicked off the network cable. So it's something that you really need to have some first-hand experience. Yeah, it's not just what the other people describe it to you. If you can't have first-hand experience and then you just have to get information from like both sides. Yeah. And then at the end, you still need to make your own judgment.
I never had seen someone make IT so deep. You linked it to history and the winner was. Have you, when you had a diverse approach to history, was there either a key event that you read about that just sounded completely different when you heard the two different sides? Like apart from just the Communist Party and the National Party, is there any other things you've studied in history that, like, have they almost don't make sense because they're so different, the narrative?
Yeah, like I'm a Christian myself, and I look at Christian histories, you have, you probably know how complicated it is.
Yeah.
So it's always two sides of. For example, if you look at the history of what happens in Israel now, right? It's so complicated. You have the Islamics, and then you have the Christians, and you have all sorts of other opinions in there. They all link it to people. But my understanding is that originally they come from the same root.
Mm.
So what is causing these conflicts between people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's not, you can't just blame it into ideology or religion. You know, it is the people that holds that belief to create the conflicts.
Yeah, yeah. I've been to Israel, and it was quite an interesting experience because I was there when Trump was going to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which is sort of like reinforcing Israel's identity and the ownership of the religious land. And there was these big threats from Hamas. We're going to open the gates of hell, and that you know, everyone, they had a national warning from the US. All US citizens should leave.
Yeah,
I went anyways. I went to Jerusalem, and there weren't any lines and stuff. But the thing was, when I watched the Western narrative of how the experience was and how crazy and scary, and it was just a couple people burning tires, and maybe one person that, you know, used their car. Hit someone,
yeah,
and it was completely fine. So it's really it is such a convoluted and confusing world.
Yeah,
and the more I know, the less I trust.
It's so true. Like you see the news, right? You see those uprisings, you see those burnings and things like that. But for people that lives in there, they notice nothing. I it's the same thing in the COVID, like in the period of time. The media says lots of people uprise in China against the lockdown rules and things like that. I asked my parents, what do you feel and how do you experience it? My parents just said, life is just per normal.
Yeah, is the world worse or is it just more newspapers?
Yeah, and the same thing, like the flood, right? Of course, we know it affected lots of people in here. But in the area that I live, and we are okay. And I talked to my wife in the day that, on that Friday. It's really bad. And my wife worked from home. And she doesn't even feel it. She just said, oh, it looks like it's heavy raining.
Mm.
You know, if your surroundings is not changed, you probably don't feel it that much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it you know, don't let the truth get in front of a good story. Yeah. That's the challenge. I mean, there are definitely people that in the Auckland floods that have been impacted. I was talking to a lady the other day.
Yes.
Her neighbors, since she drowned, got washed down the street. Yep. And it's like... And then you know, there's a massive amount of damage and what's up. But even then, even as tragic and horrible as it is, on the Richter scale of tragedy, it's quite, you know, it's not that bad, which is not a smart thing to say, especially publicly. It's just that's the thing. And it's blown out of this massive proportion and how awful it is for so many people. And
I feel that it's sometimes the biggest problem is that we look at the issue and we blow it up because of medias and, you know, the exposures and things like that. And some of the things, like the normal life side of it, nobody reported. Right? So out of a scale of 100, like how many people affected? You know what I mean? I'm not saying it's not serious, but for the life of many people, they probably didn't feel the pain.
Yeah, yeah. I think the magnitude wasn't proportionate, like the way it was covered proportionate to the magnitude of what was actually happening. But this is not a smart topic.
Yeah, I know.
Welcome to the world of public opinion. So okay, IT, you're gonna do environmental. Did you just start, you know, crying every time you read your books when you're like, oh, I gotta do computer science because my English? Or when did you start being like, okay, I came from a farmer. I don't know how much tech you had. Did you have a computer in your farm?
No.
Yeah.
Okay, put it this way. Like, I grew up, I tell you a little bit about the history about myself, right? I grew up in the farming area. So I stayed there when I was in the middle school. After I finished intermediate school, I go to high school. And in high school, I move away from the village into a little city.
Cool.
Yeah. About half a million people. That is called very little cities in China. Yeah. Okay. From there on, we have our first telephone, the landline, when I was in high school. Okay. We have a black and white TV when I was in primary school, but it's not owned by us, but our neighbors.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So when do I have started to have my computer? It's probably, I don't have my own computer, but I learned computer when I was in university back in China. That is in the 90s. Yeah. And I really own a computer when I came to New Zealand.
Well, how did they fund your university? Because farmers, you say, lower class, struggling. Maybe they're really good farmers. But how did you get into uni? Did you have to borrow? You get a scholarship? You worked? Or?
My parents later on, like, a star is a farmer, but my dad went into business when I kind of in my high school time. So at that time, and he was able to support me. It's not that expensive in China when you go to university.
Okay.
So yeah, yeah. So that is kind of okay.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But study in university, I learned a little bit about computing. Yeah. Because environmental management, we do a bit of researches and stuff like that. So at the time, we do have computers to use.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God, as soon as you looked at it, like, this is amazing. And then you're up there till midnight and breaking in just to use it again. Or
no, you don't even have means to touch it. You can only use it, touch the keyboard, that's all you can.
Oh, you can't even touch the screen.
Yeah, not a lot. You know, it's in the old times, you have a computer room. It is managed by staff and things like that. You only go apply, you know, go to a certain hour, use the computer, and then you leave. You know, not until I came to New Zealand, and then we bought our own computers and start to break it and then do the way how we want. The main purpose is to play games, okay? So we know how to set up our own computers, configure it, and make our first network that is in the 1997, and then I invite a couple friends and we play Warcraft.
I'm Warcraft, not sure if you know that. Hey, one yeah. of those, so yeah.
That is where we start, where I start to really get some grip of computers. So we learn docs. You probably don't know what those are.
Docs.
Docs, yeah. That is before Windows.
Ah.
Yeah.
I don't know. There was a before Windows.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I know. So it's kind of like Linux, right? You have command lines and you have to type things. You don't have visual. You just only see all those lines, you know, like in Matrix, you see all those things dropping and you have to understand what they mean.
Yeah. Wow.
So that is where we start our computers. Yeah.
What was the first thing you created or did? Did you try and make your own game? Did you do coding? Did you unpack a computer, put it back together? What was the first aha moment where you're like, wow, this is interesting?
The first thing I touched, the deal with computer is like we want to play Warcraft. At that time, the computers are not as powerful as now you have, right? You have to do some menu configurations and make sure the sound card works, the graphic card works, and that kind of things. So that is where I really get into understand what is the memory, how come there's not enough memory to load the games, and you know, start to understand those basic concepts.
Interesting. So your desire to play games taught you
everything. Yeah. You know, like the network is not like as easy as what we have now. You just plug in and it works. And you have to do menu configuration. You have to know what is IP address, gateways, and all those little things. At the time, we don't even have a switch. We use hubs. And hubs, you have to have special cables to connect, how to connect them together. So at the old days, they are not as convenient as now.
Yeah, it's crazy how many kids, well, you weren't a kid then, you're older, but like the desire to play or either to meet women or something, you know what I mean? Like so, play games or meet your future wife, how motivated and inspiring people and the things they will do. Anyway, okay, so you do your study, they're like, your English isn't good, do computer science. Like, okay, I played a bit of World of Warcraft, fuck it, let's do it. And then you finish your studies, what were, like, when did you want to start this business?
Well, I actually spent a couple of years after my study to do missionary work for church.
Mm.
And then after that, I come back to Auckland and I start to look for works, and I have done some freelancers supports. And I start to love it because I can solve problems. And because of my background, use docs and things like that. So I really can reach to the back end, like things you cannot see, to trying to understand what is the problem. So from there on, I start to love the job. But the problem is that, you know, again, communication is a big problem. You know, techie guys, they don't want to talk to people. So it's very difficult to get customer. So, and there's an opportunity to become a franchisee of a IT support company.
Mm.
So, and I actually purchased that a franchise and then get into the business from there.
Did it get messy?
Yes.
Yeah, I had a feeling. Yeah, but then you got your missionary thing. Is it like, just to rewind a little bit?
Yeah.
Where did you go? Was any like really war-torn
impoverished or just what were you?
No, I was mainly in the southern part of New Zealand.
Yeah. That probably doesn't. Anyways, we'll move forward. I thought you might be in Uganda or something.
No. Okay, I was in New Zealand. Yeah.
Okay. Well, very nice of you to out there saving souls.
Yeah.
Okay. So franchise. So you went in normally. What's the normal structure with a franchise? You buy in.
Yep.
Then you get their systems and processes and no real support, and then you realize, what the fuck have I done? Or how does that work?
Okay. Well, the franchise, there's good things because franchise, they actually help you to promote your brands and get customer for you. Yeah. At that time, systems are not as complicated or as sufficient like what we have nowadays. So to invest on a system is a huge amount of money. At the time, our franchise, we get up to about 30 to 40 nationwide.
Big.
But we don't have a very good back-end system to actually manage the clients and the jobs and things like that. At the end, the whole franchise system collapses because there's not sufficient income for the franchise owner to promote the brand.
Mm.
So that is one thing I learned is very important. You need to have a good system to support a structure like that. Yeah. That is also one thing I talk to my clients that if you want to have a big operation, your system is very important.
Yeah.
Yep, I learned from the franchise experience. It's not that the franchise not making money. They do. They do radio ads, and at that time it's doing yellow pages. Right. You know, it's very expensive. But what they spend, they cannot get it back as an investment. So that is why eventually the franchise system, it just doesn't work. But at the time, I do learn a lot of things and I accumulate a very good customer base.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So put it this way, if you were to start a franchise and fix everything, would it be the main value you would provide is systems and processes and then leads?
And leads. And one more thing is very important is the support at the back end. Not all the technicians are very high skill. Yeah. You can't expect that. You know? So you do need to, like, if you call up like a Spark or Vodafone, sometimes you have help desk. And then if it's not working, they have to go up to a tier one or tier two support. So you need to have something like that. You can't just rely on just one person to solve all the problems. Yeah.
Okay, so tiered support network for the franchisees or for the clients?
For the franchisees. So they can rely on somebody if they can't fix the problem.
Yeah, because I always think about, because my, I don't know how much you know about me, but my dream is to give everyone the opportunity to live a fulfilling life.
Yes.
Which is a big goal, and I can't do it on my own. So I was thinking, how would I, you know, mobilize and incentivize people? And I thought, you know, franchise model where, you know, we could use our marketing and also, you know, process and ability to train people and support them. And that could reach a certain scale. But I know nothing. My business acumen is non-existent. But yeah, it's just interesting hearing you say that.
I can share with you another experience like related to what I do now. So before, like when I first start, we call it a break and fix. You know, if somebody break, we come and fix it. But now you won't survive in that environment. At the old times, like your computer probably break every couple months. Nowadays, the computer probably lasts for the lifetime.
Mm.
So hardware wise, right? So what do you have to do? You don't have many break and fix. Okay. So we change it from break and fix into a managed service provider. So as a managed service provider, we trying to look after your securities, your patch managements, your backups, and all those things related to the business running continuity. So we want to make sure that whatever disaster or accident happened, you still have something to get your business keep going. So we changed it into such a model. And with this model, just like what I said, you need a software platform, or you need a platform to be able to do the manage, monitoring, and support. So there's quite a few different big players. They provide the system. And then you just become part of them as a partner. And then you can use a system, for example, like we're talking about ransomware and we're talking about all those cybersecurity attacks. So as a platform, they have the research and development ability. They can identify very quickly what are the threats out in the world.
Mm.
And then they provide you tools, provide you solutions. And all we do is we become their partner. We subscribe to the service. And then we provide it to our clients.
Yeah, and it's a smart model because, you know, essentially you're selling peace of mind and service.
Yeah.
And provided that you continue to provide peace of mind and good service. Do you think there's a change in that? Like, you know, my generation are like, oh, price, I can do it myself. And are you seeing a shift in business owners from that old school? Like, a good example is our business is he hand delivers Christmas cakes to 250 clients every year. And you know, a lot of clients could do this themselves. You get a managed fund, you leave it alone.
Yeah.
You hang in there when it goes down. But what they sort of see it as his money. They give him the money to invest so they don't have to worry about it. And then they appreciate the cups of tea and the catching up and talking about life. But fundamentally, the investment doesn't change. So are you seeing a shift in business owners and what they expect and what they want?
Not really a shift. It is, well, you can put it this way, like it's the experience that you have. The business owners, they don't. They can, like lots of things, they can follow the instructions step by step and doing it. I do have customers trying to do that. I'm a Google reseller. I'm Google partner. So we sell Google Workspace, the email platform. You can go online. If you are very techie, it takes you about 10 minutes to do it. But there's jargons inside. I have a customer trying to do it himself, and it takes him about 2 days, and he still could not find out where is the DNS, where is my name server host, who is handling this, who is handling that. Because as business owners, you don't have that knowledge. Mm. Of course, they have the help. They will point you one by one. You know, you get it here, you get it this, you get it this. By the time you read all the menus and steps, it's also a day gone. But it's supposed for us, it's only about an hour's of job.
Yeah, yeah. I think I can tell for the most part whether a business owner will be successful or not. And the two determining factors are they willing to delegate to staff well as to professionals?
Yep.
And then do they have enough self-awareness to drop their ego and their belief systems holding back?
Exactly, just like antivirus, right? And lots of people say, I just go and have Norman to get the Norton antivirus put into my computer. That's fine. Most of people can do that. And then you will end up like, we have a funny experience. And then I have seen a customer has three antivirus the system, like a program on the system. There's some knowledge they don't have. It's not that they don't have all the knowledge. They can still do certain things. Yeah.
Yeah, there's my business associate, he says, you can do your own electrical work if you want. You just might end up as a black mess in the corner.
Exactly. So it is the risk that you don't have enough knowledge to avoid.
Yeah.
So it's not that you can't follow the steps. That's an interesting topic because I'm getting into a little bit in digital marketing, right? Because you can't avoid it. So because I deal with Google, so I do I help my customers manage their Google my business profiles.
Oh yeah.
And even it's a very simple thing. You can follow the step by step and do it. But at the end, how to configure your post, how to make sure that you get your address right, and all those things at the end. Customer I don't want to bother, just go ahead and manage it for me.
Yeah, well, and I think a common thing I hear business owners talk about is burnout, and I often find that it isn't a lack of work-life balance, it's a lack of balance in the work they do because they're doing things they don't want to do.
Exactly. Like for come back to this digital presentations online, right? You have Google My Business, you have a Facebook page, mm-hmm. right? And then some of them, they do Google AdWords and all sorts of other, like you have your LinkedIn profiles. At the end, I find out business owners, they get lost because so many of them. And one thing is interesting is that most of them, they can't remember the logins.
Yeah.
And that's what we are there for, to help them to organize and manage things.
How do you do it? Because obviously, you know, you're using these processes. You have a few staff, which is tricky because you're the hero for everything. How do you manage your time as an individual, or what do you think is stopping you from going to another level of more staff, or you just don't want it and you love the lifestyle, you got your clients? What do you think is happening in your world?
I just want to get it a little bit more established. I have a goal. I don't want more than 3 staff locally.
Interesting.
Because our jobs are all systematic. It means everything's supposed to be in the system. Yeah. And all those managements and maintenance and all those patches are actually done in the background. All I need is somebody, if there's exceptional things happens, they will respond to it. Or to configure it in the beginning and make sure everything is running smoothly. So we have a dashboard, shows all the things and which one is exceptional. And then we look at it. Do we need to action to it or not?
Yeah. So you don't really need staff. Not too many. How, is there a limit of clients that you could reach?
Not really.
Wow.
With our system, right? If you can...
you could do 10,000?
Probably not.
You could answer the phone.
We do have a ratio because about 5% of our customers will have problem. If we set it up really well, I only need to revisit the customer once a year.
Yeah.
If you have an IT support come to see you every month, you need to think, is my system set up properly?
Yeah. That's a good point. Because so there's 2 ways to look at it. There's one, this person's coming every month. I can see they're putting in all the services value. But also their system needs to be fixed every month, so maybe it's not as good.
Exactly.
How does it work? So I was talking to an IT guy the other day, and he was talking about how he uses Google as well. Yeah. And I'm like, well, fucking Google MySpace is, what, $20 a month or whatever?
Yeah.
And maybe you've got 100 staff and you need these different licenses. But how do you live on that? Do you guys sell hardware, or how's your business? You're getting 1% of $20 a month? You know what I mean?
I tell you what.
This is a rude
question. The hardware at the moment, the margin is so low.
Yeah.
Less than 1%.
Yeah.
I can get a laptop for a customer. If you use the market value, probably we can get lucky get $20 out of $1,500 laptop. So, and lots of those softwares, they actually offer commissions, and they have a lot better margins for wholesalers like us.
So you do a software package, and then maybe a consultation setup implementation fee.
Yeah,
I know this is people aren't as forthright with these sort of things. I'm always curious in a person's business model in terms of recurring revenue. How do they manage their time? How do they manage the processes and their systems? Yeah. It sounds like you don't necessarily want to manage a lot of people. You kind of dealing with, you know, the issue and the problem.
It's the platform. For example, we do antivirus, right? Everybody still need an antivirus, even though it's not less risk, but antivirus is still one of the biggest to all the computers. So with our managed model now, subscriptions is very simple. If you subscribe to it, we just continually renew it for you and invoice you yearly or monthly.
And do they pay more or less if they go direct?
They won't pay less because we get the commissions from the provider, the software. Yeah. So it's not, we don't get the money from the customer.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it's that's similar to a mortgage broker model.
Yeah, because it's kind of like we promote the product.
Yeah.
Okay. So because I have to subscribe to the software as a reseller, So it's kind of, I am the marketing people.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So instead of paying for a staff, they pay us. We promote it for them.
It's crazy. Like those two things, recruitment and sales.
Yeah.
There's always going to be someone that can pay for it because they it's hard.
Very expensive if you want to hire a marketing guy or a sales guy.
Yeah, and most of them don't manage anything. Because, you know, the reality is if you have a whole lot of sales people that are actually good and you're aligned because, you know, it's performance-based, I mean, that it's hard to beat that.
Mm, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you give a great salesperson 1,000 numbers that they don't know. That they'll, you know, and they usually earn more than the business owner, the top salespeople. Yeah, they do. Quite crazy.
They do.
Interesting. So you essentially, you go into a business and you're like, here are all the things that could help you and simplify things. Mm. And we don't need to make it complicated.
Yep.
And we have all these different products that we'll pull together.
Yep.
And then we'll just, see you next year. Like, it's pretty good. Unless something goes wrong.
No. We do provide reports every month. We need to let them know this is something that you pay for. It's okay. Not that we are doing nothing, okay? I have to show you patch managements, securities, backups.
What's patch management?
You know, like Windows, right? They always have updates.
Okay.
Have you ever got issues with Windows updates?
Yeah.
Mm. If you don't manage it properly, you often get the patch installed and then your computer stuck.
Mm.
Or you some of the critical security updates is not been installed, so there's also issues.
Wow, and you're essentially free apart from the first thing, or you have something else.
That is what we call it, a managed model.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the software itself have the ability to do the jobs you ask them to. So if you plan it properly, it is very smooth. That's why I have a customer that I signed up probably about 5 years ago. At that time, they use Linux system. And they do have an internal staff that is kind of quite good at it. So they got free service from the staff, so they don't get other people to help them. And eventually the staff left and they leave them a whole huge mess of servers and nobody knows how to configure. So eventually I moved there. They have their local email server, security server and everything locally, running and Linux base. And I come in and look at it. I said, no, that is not my specialty too. And I don't think you can get a cheap like IT support on that kind of product. So I just offer them a solution, move all the emails to Google Workspace. And after that, I don't have go back to them. And every year I just charge them a renewal and occasionally doing some setups.
Yeah.
So that is how you solve a problem. It's not necessarily fix it. It's kind of you use an alternative that is a lot easier, simpler. That's why I say we want to make IT easy.
Mm.
Yeah. So that is how it works for me.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And then your business model is, I wouldn't say easy, but it doesn't need to be labor intensive. You know what I mean? It's systemized and processed. So you're going from making it easy for them while having a business that's kind of not easy, but getting new clients would be hard.
Yep. That's what I am working on to get new clients. I have signed up a few new clients recently because, you know, the financial market authority, they have lots of guidelines about cybersecurity.
Yeah, it's good timing.
So we offer that managed package to the financial advisors and make sure that they comply. They have all the backups and they are checked with all like the risk of, you know, the privacy exposures, how to protect their data. And all those things, I package it into one package and send it to them so they can have a peace of mind. And if the financial market authority come to audit them, I can provide all the, you know, the records and tell them we have done this, we have done this, we have done this.
Yeah, it's smart. I mean, like, yeah. a lot of them are, you know, because, from the 90s.
Because lots of the financial advisors, they use quite a bit of a system. Yeah. And they don't necessarily need to have a very huge IT bill. because these things with our managed solution, we just need to know what you need to protect, and then we give you the solution to it.
Yeah, that's interesting, eh? I've never actually gone too in depth in the IT, because I was initially, when I was gonna with this business, I was thinking, okay, I'll help medium sized businesses because I like, you know, the complexity of staff and how that works. And essentially, I call and book people in for a podcast for them. Mm. And so if there's like 20 staff, then they then we just feed the salespeople with the podcast, and the podcast getting shared everywhere and yada yada yada.
Yep.
And the two biggest industries were recruitment and IT. Like, well, why are you guys, you know, I was like, what are you guys doing? Why are you just like nearly every business for those two? They the others can't scale. Yeah. Like accountants, the lawyers sometimes.
Because accounting jobs is very intensive labor.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
Very intensive labor. It's IT, is that if you set it up properly, just like what I said, set it up properly, and then we have the ability to scale up quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you learn that lesson from franchising too.
That's right.
It's smart. Like, then what's the dream? Like, do you find it fulfilling? Like, is it an end goal? Like, what do you want out of it?
Just like what you're expecting, like a freedom. You set up a system, it's running by itself.
Yeah, yeah.
That is what my dream.
Okay. Are you're close to that?
I still need to do the sales at the moment. So my system back end is already set up. So I'm ready to move forward.
So how much time would you need to, if you didn't do any sales or networking, how much time would you need to put in, like, let's say a week?
A week for 10 hours?
Yeah. In the, wow. Hey. How long has the business been going for?
The franchise actually finished in about 2014.
Mm.
So, and I have some health issues, and I start my business again in 2018.
Oh, yeah.
So that's how long I have been coming back to the business.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you got it all set up, and then you just got to go out there and start selling.
That's right.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting. Well, we've done 53 minutes, and we talked about China, we talked about your upbringing, the differentiation between classes in China was quite interesting. What would, on the sales front, who should find you, and why should they find you?
Small, medium business owners. You know, they just don't have the time to do all these things. Like what I just mentioned, if you're a financial advisor, you have enough to take care of. You don't need to go and do those monitoring, auditing, and send the reports to financial market authorities, say, hey, I'm compliant, you know. So those are the things that we can help. Yeah.
And how do they find you?
Just call me.
Are you going to put your number on there? Are you a brave man? Yeah, yeah.
Just visit our website. So always good to come to our website, or just give me a call directly. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'll put your number and your website in the description.
Yeah, yeah.
And thanks for coming on.
Thank you.